I've worked in the aviation industry and I've worked on these big programs, but these big programs all had extreme tight deadlines and they had extreme set budgets, right? There was not a lot of fluidity in any of it. And you really, your day was kind of figuring out how to reach the finish line in the compressed schedule and budget that they were giving you to work with.
You're listening to the Building Better Futures podcast, where innovation meets inspiration. In each episode, host Eric Hirani journeys alongside notable thought leaders who are shaping the future, cultivating exceptional work cultures, and nurturing the next generation of trailblazers. We aim to spark inspiration by engaging in dialogue with leaders from groundbreaking companies, innovative projects, and exceptional teams. Our goal is to empower individuals to positively impact those around them and leave a lasting legacy of positive change in our communities and society at large. Let's dive in together and explore what it takes to build better futures, one conversation at a time.
Today, I'm joined by Palmina Whalen, Capital Program Director of Terminal 1 at JFK and founder of PWSS. Palmina, thanks for taking the time to talk to me today. Before we get to the core conversation, I always like to start with like good news and gratitude, something we practice here at the company, and I also just practice in my personal life. So any professional or personal like good news or gratitude you'd like to share with me or the audience?
Well, I think general gratitude for the ability to wake up in the morning and have the opportunity to experience that day.
Amazing. I love it. You know, I do a lot with gratitude personally and like journaling. And sometimes that's the best thing you've got. It's just amazing. Like the weather's nice out today. Who would have thought that for November, Yep. You know, late in November. Very cool. My gratitude's always to the guests on show days. Everyone's busy, especially in the world today. And for you to make time to talk to me is just amazing. So I'm grateful for that. So thank you. All right. So let's jump into it. Tell us about yourself, your background. Where did you grow up? Your current role? Just tell us about Palmina.
Oh, Eric, how far back do you want me to go?
Go back. Where'd you grow up?
All right. We'll do it simple. Well, some of your audience may relate to this. Well, I am a daughter, first generation. So immigrant family, moved here from Italy. Some folks don't know this, but English was my second language. I spoke Italian. I was fluent in Italian up until, I want to say, the third grade, where I grew up in a very blue-collar neighborhood. So it was very important back then that people learned how to speak English. Bilingual was not as acceptable as it is today. So I did, in third grade, transition from Italian to English as my predominant language. I did grow up in Queens, which makes a lot of sense of my personality for those who really get to know me. And I originally was going to college for computer science. So construction wasn't even in my plan, although construction has been in my environment and I've been surrounded by it through my family members with my dad and uncles and cousins and all. So my predominant family world, the men are all in the build industry, while the women are either bankers or bankers. I grew up in a very, very cultural family where, ironically, for the cultural aspect of it, it was very equal. And there was a lot of focus on education for our entire generation because we were the first generation to really define and live out the American dream for my parents and for all my aunts and uncles that came over from Italy.
That is so cool. I learned so much of that I did not know about you. I didn't know that English was your second language. I didn't know you went to school for computer science.
Computer science, I know. And you know, the irony of that, Eric, is I end up leaving computer science because back in the day, not that I'm past the age of 25, but back in the day, it was a predominantly male-oriented business. And I thought, this isn't working for me. I can't break through this mindset and I'm going to have to change curriculums. And it just must be my personality because here I am. I went industry that was very male dominated.
I was going to say, I don't know if computer science, the construction solved that problem.
I don't think it did, but it resonated a lot more. It just resonated better.
No, that's great. So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was like, what did initially draw you to the industry? And I've heard you speak about it. I've heard you speak to the next generation about it, but you're very passionate about construction and the built environment. So what kind of drew you to it and what keeps you passionate about it?
Well, I'm not sure what drew me to it, except that, as I said earlier, it's very familiar for me, right? Dad being in the contracting business, having a lot of male cousins in my world and very much like different cultures. Your friends really are your cousins first, right? Until you're able to establish them for school. But in our group, it was always related about construction. My father did not discriminate against whether I was a male or a female. And he took me with him or had me incorporated in a lot of the day-to-day activities that he did, predominantly at home, right, for some jobs with him when he had to babysit me or whatever the situations might have been. So I think it was just an organic fit. It just fit the DNA. It just felt familiar. And I started my career in construction at J. Crew when I got my first job working as an overall project assistant in the corporate real estate department when J. Crew was building a lot of stores back in the heyday. And, you know, I was involved with, they had their own internal design team. They had their own internal construction team. And we just went around, looked at spaces, selected spaces, designed them, put them out to bid, and then managed the construction. And it just became fluid from that. And I think it just, it felt natural. And I really liked being on the owner side of the fence.
That's so cool. I didn't know. So you started out more, I mean, that's like the vertical side and you're doing retail fit out?
So I started a retail fit out. From there, I went to a company called Dickinson Camera Construction. They were a predominant big GC that did a lot of retail. They wanted to start a New York branch. So I had helped them start the New York market. They quickly realized that New York was probably a tough industry and it took a little while to get the relationships with the subcontractors. So they had decided to revisit their venture. And then from there, I went to go work for Marco Mattelli, where I learned a lot about doing interior fit out in healthcare, like radiology centers, hospitals, healthcare facilities. And from there, I pivoted and I went to go work for O'Brien Kreitzberg in the construction management division. And from O'Brien Kreitzberg, I pivoted to opening up STVCM division. So I was joined forces with Brian Flaherty, Joe Ligamari, Vince Sebastian back in the heyday, right? And a couple of our colleagues where we started this STVCM. Got tired of doing, I would say, city and state agency work. Went to go work for Carter Burgess at the time before it became Jacobs, who placed me at American Airlines. And then when I was at American Airlines, they just asked me to join forces with them, be one of their employees, a direct hire. And I was with American Airlines from 2001 till 2020, where I took a retirement package.
You know, you got into retail fit out, right? So I'm sure you learned a lot there. Then you went into the healthcare space. Then you went into the CM space. And then you continued on the CM space, it sounds, but more on the aviation side. So as you're continuing and thinking about this remarkable journey that you're on, right? Looking back, what are some of the biggest shifts you've seen in construction and construction management, just in general? And how is that being applied to airport work that you've maybe seen in the more recent part of your career or aviation work?
Well, a lot of the shifts that happen, and I'm going to speak as a female, starting her journey a little bit earlier than the days that we have today. It was that there were more and more women coming into the workforce, right? When I had started originally, and I'll say more at O'Brien Kreitzberg, where you did a lot more of the city and state work, it was an environment where there were just, it was more heavily male dominated versus female, right? Not to suggest that there weren't women, there just weren't as many women who was interested in the build industry, specific to engineering or architectural. It just wasn't the norm. But as I developed and grew and went from OBK to STV and then Carter Burgess, it was just nice to be with like-minded people, right? There were other women in the room. There were also professionals, not only having to deal with male colleagues, not that there's anything wrong with male colleagues, but it was nice to see similar people in the room. It was nice to see that this was an industry that people were attracted to, that women were attracted to. I also feel that there's been a transition in the maturity. The construction management, right? The maturity internally from a personality aspect of it, and then also transitioning from brick and mortar to how do we do things better, the efficiencies to technology, right? So the evolution that it moves forward. And now specific to aviation, I'm going to say that when I started first, it was about operational efficiencies, predominant result, right? How do we get the airplane to the gate and where do we build a building from there? And not that's changed, but what's changed is that we've spent a lot of time on not only operational efficiencies, but the passenger journey and the employee journey, right? What are those experiences like? And what do they translate back to the design of the facility? And ultimately, can you really measure that with an ROI? So there's been a couple, I think I gave you maybe three or four. I'm sure there's a ton more, but specifically for me, those are the ones that really stood out.
No, that's so cool. And I will say, I think you're part of the reason for a lot of women I know being inspired and being in the industry. You know, I know you and Christine Oates also are very instrumental in doing that with CMA. So we appreciate that. And it's nice to hear that. I guess that was a big impact in your life, right? So I guess seeing other women in the industry and collaborating with them made you realize, well, I can do this, right? I can continue to progress for this.
Yeah. Because it was a little bit astonishing to go from coming from a very cultural Italian background in the house, right? Where me being in the field with other men was very accepted and wasn't seen like an oddity, but to go into an office and then there was almost a feeling like, oh, there is a difference, right? I didn't think there was, but maybe there is. And I need to acknowledge this and know how to work around it.
So you mentioned technology as one of those things that you've seen change. And I'm curious, looking ahead, what role do you think technology plays in transforming like design and construction? And are there any like really, are there innovative practices you're seeing now or like excited to work on?
That's a really good question, Eric, because I've been living in design world, but predominantly aviation, right? And our world is really daunted with what, it's really world what the agencies are going to do, right? If the FAA has a certain process, then we're going to have to adhere to the FAA. If the port has their process, we have to adhere to it. I do think that design changes as far as maybe the implementation of technology to make the aviation processing and operating world a better place to be in, right? With the sense of biometric, sense of a lot of these items, that tasks that you can do online that can help calm the anxiety before the person comes over to the airport, because you have a lot of tangible information in your hand, right? That reduces anxiety for those that travel. I do the fact that a lot of things are touchless now, right? Cash, like a lot of the airports are no longer accepting cash. So it makes it so the journey is just a little bit less things you have to think about, a little bit less things you have to carry. And it allows for the point of sale to happen a little bit quicker, and as well as the operational efficiencies to come with that.
I'll say checking in my phone, amazing. I know that's been going on for a while, but way better than having to get there and print a boarding pass and wait to do that. The other one, and this is good or bad, good when they tell you your luggage is on the plane, bad when you've departed and you realize your luggage is not on the plane. But I guess—
What if you're tracking it?
Yeah. At least now, because I'm looking at my phone, I'm like, okay, good. My bag is on.
Yeah. Good. Right. Right. And people don't realize those little things, they really add anxiety.
They do. Yeah.
Right. So if we can mitigate the amount of anxiety that you're experiencing, your journey will be better because your decisions will be smarter.
Yeah. But even just the overall look, touch and feel of some of these new like airports and terminals, I mean, they're beautiful. Like the architecture, they no longer feel, it's not just utilitarian, right? Like it's not just, hey, we got to get a plane to this gate and then we need to get the plane out of it. It's like, you know, how do we, you mentioned earlier, like customer experience, right? Like a passenger experience. How do we make the passenger experience better? And there's at LaGuardia, there's some beautiful things that they've done. And I've flown a few times out of there and JFK looks really nice in the places that have been renovated. I know there's a lot more to do, but the technology component I've seen a lot is it's not just on the construction side, but it's a lot about how they allow passengers or users to interface with, you know, what they're about to experience, right? Like the ticketing and the baggage claim and all that stuff. So it's been really excited to see.
Yeah. And I think the push notifications help a lot too, because they're telling you a lot of the concerns back then was a lack of communication through the, you know, push notifications through the technology. It's like, you know, what's coming up. It's highlighting the path of what next steps you need to take.
No, it's very cool.
This episode is brought to you by Infinite Consulting Corp., your go-to firm for MBE certified project and construction management consulting. Discover how Infinite can help you build a better future at infiniteconsultingcorp.com.
So I always like to give a guest the chance to talk about like an impactful project they were a part of. And I learned a lot about your history today. I didn't even know about all of that basically prior to American Airlines. But we like to focus on the show like how construction, engineering, architecture all impact for the public good, right? Public community and public good. Is there like any one or two particular projects you'd like to talk about that you're like, I'm so proud or glad that I was part of that? It really impacted the way people experience whatever that journey in their life is, right? Whether it's going shopping at a retail center or going in for a healthcare procedure or traveling, you know, I mean, kind of touching on all of them.
So I've probably spent the 15 plus years last year was in aviation. And I will say, Eric, honestly, I was very blessed at American Airlines. I had the opportunity to have a handful of really good projects that I know had an impact on life, that had impact on the airport community. It had an impact on the passengers, right? It had an impact on the employees. I started my career at American with JFK Terminal 8 when it was first built out. So that program finished in 2007. Now that was JFK Terminal 8 was a program that was salvaged despite the incidents of the 9/11 situation, right? So when 9/11 happened, JFK Terminally was at risk of what do we do next, because the program was in the middle of starting construction. So for that program to go through with such a monumental project at its time, because it represented the commitment from the aviation industry, besides, despite the fact of what caused, right? They were an element in the cause, right? They weren't the cause, but they were an element of how, there were conduit, I should say, of how, you know, what had happened. But the project also represents the Port Authority, it represents JFK, it represents the aviation community, and to people at whole that, yeah, we can still keep moving. We're going to move forward, right? Nothing's going to be able to stop us. It's a monumental moment. It's a pivotal moment. And our position is we're strong and we're going to build this program and we're going to finish this project. Now, granted, we had to stop and reevaluate, but we end up finishing the project. And it's a testament to the commitment that everybody made and a testament to the financial sponsors that committed to the program. And then I was able to go from that to LaGuardia, where there was, you know, short-term and long-term commitments. Short-term, we made as American Airlines, I was able to lead modifications into one of the concourses, even for that short-term buy of, hey, we need to fix our concourse here a little bit and give a better passenger experience. So then sitting literally side by side with the Port Authority as the largest key stakeholder in CTB renovation and having an impact in defining what that program would be, right? Defining and planning and focusing and developing it with SOM and with the Port Authority and what the new LaGuardia would turn out to be. And then having an integral part of playing our part on the American Airlines responsibilities and enabling what said how to happen. To pivot also to doing DFW and revisiting and having the opportunity with DFW Airport Authority and American Airlines. And although it never came into fruition, but redefining what DFW meant, right? What does the DFW landscape really look like short-term and long-term? And what do we want to be, right, in the next 10 or 15 and 20 years to now at being at the JFK Terminal 1 and leading and building the new JFK Terminal 1. So when I tell you I've been blessed, I'm in awe sometimes of the opportunities that I've been given and the thumbprint that I've been able to lead at these really big legacy programs and the impact that it meant to all the communities around them.
When you fly into DFW, right, does it bring back all these memories?
Yeah, I probably don't smile as much. I probably take a deep breath,
yeah,
myself with the heat that's coming, right? And then shake off a little bit of all of that.
I do want to touch on what you said about T8 coming through after 9/11. And I was recently at the Psy Gala and Steve Plate spoke and they did this amazing tribute video to basically, you know, everything that Port Authority did post 9/11 and the Freedom Tower and the memorial and yeah. the mall. And
have you
and
gone
everything.
To the memorial? They did a
phenomenal. I have.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And what they've done is amazing. But it speaks to what you were saying, which is that at a time where we were all just unsure about everything, construction and the city carried on. And, you know, I had this conversation, I think, with the previous guest, was contractors showed up the day after 9/11 and were like, where do you need me? How can I help? It wasn't about anything else. What can we do to get the city through this and help get us all through this? So I think it's really cool. I didn't know that history about T8 particularly, but I applaud you guys for continuing and charging forward at a time that was probably so uncertain, right? You know, like today you look back on it, it's like, oh yeah, we got that done and it makes sense, but it could have gone wrong probably a million different times between.
Yeah, right, right. Because you're dealing with so much raw emotion, right? So you're doing a program, you're in it, you're going forward on it, but then you're also dealing with the situation that really happened to the city, particularly the city that you're in, right? And there's raw emotion, there's families that were impacted, there was it was American Airlines, right? It was the aircraft, it was aviation. So there was a lot going on, a lot. But yeah, and when it was done, it had, for me personally, it had that much more of an impact on the completion, right? So, and not a lot of people know that story, but even just for myself, I know that story. And that story for me is this program really meant a lot. And as I said earlier, I was really blessed to be part of it.
It united the city in a way that was a tragic event, but amazing to see a city.
The outcome, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, I'm going to go back a little bit, right? You were telling me a little bit about your history and how you started to see other women in the industry and that really empowered you in some ways. You know, as someone who's seen a lot of change in that environment, what do you think is still needed for women and underrepresented groups to feel welcome and come into our industry?
That's an interesting question, Eric, because it's an insinuation in that question that people need to make us feel welcome to come in, right? And I grew up as first generation. My parents coming to America, not speaking English, coming here for the first time, right? Restarting their life, building the American dream. And they quickly taught me that I needed to make myself fit in, right? Because people weren't going, this concept of people are just going to make, help you fit in probably didn't exist. And it was a job that they had, you know, it was a trade that they had to work on and something, a trade that they taught me. And I think for the most part, and I probably say this to a lot more women than I do to other folks, but I would say generally speaking, you just have to know that you deserve the seat at the table. You have to know that you belong there. And like, and that's a simple statement because that statement has so much depth to it. But you have to at least know that you belong there. And if you accept that you belong there, that other things start to organically fall into place. Because it's when you feel that you don't belong that you start, you know, one can start creating all of these elements and issues and anxieties in their own head that may or may not exist, right? No one really knows. But if you feel like you belong there, then your whole personality changes and then you just go in it. And when you're in it, you're in it.
That is such an amazing take on that question, you know, and not that I asked that question verbatim, but I've asked similar questions to other guests. And everyone's always got their unique, right? Everyone's got their own life experience. But I love that. It's not so much about having everyone else make you feel more welcome. It's about welcoming yourself. Sit down and say something and speak up and perform, right? Be competent, do a good job, and you'll have a seat at the table. That's very cool. I love that. You mentioned you talk to women and maybe even other groups of people, but I know you're very involved in the industry, right? So you're an industry leader, WBC, CMAA, Building Congress, and you devote a lot of time to these organizations. Why do you do that? Like, why is it important to be involved?
Well, let's go back to the question you just asked, the one that just before about that I answered about being in the room. I think if people do have a hard time feeling like they belong in a place, these organizations is a really good way to get yourself involved. Right? It minimizes your audience. It minimizes the amount of people that you get to see because they're typically repeat people. So you do then have the ability to start learning how to build networks, how to practice, how to make relationships, right? How to maybe remove some of the anxiety, how to learn about different things that may be similar or not similar. And then more importantly, that translates into general business practice. Belonging to a network is probably, I would say, one of the most critical things in nurturing your career. It's because you will go to events, either educational forums, right? Forums to go meet colleagues that you haven't met before, but really with this mindset of building relationship, it teaches you how to nurture and build relationships. It teaches you what's relevant or what subject is important at that time. So you can distinguish maybe through your business, what is it that you need to go chase or what is it that you need to put aside or reconsider, right? And the beauty of it also is that through friendships, you also find mentors, right? Or like-minded people that you can really share stories with or share experiences and get some lessons learned. And it's almost as if it's free coaching, right? People pay for executive coaching, but you can get a lot of that through networking. You can get a lot of that through these organizations because there's people from young, especially now, you have young professionals all the way through to those retirees that come back as SMEs. That vast outreach is typically not accessible outside of an organization. And to get a perspective from someone from a young professional all the way up to the SMEs is so important because it gives you that broad band, like really diversified and global input that I think it just makes you smarter when you make decisions because you've thought about holistically all different angles that maybe you normally wouldn't have thought about if you didn't have the outreach.
Yeah, you can put yourself in shoes that you're typically not in, right? When you see the perspective of someone, how someone else views, you're like, I never thought of it that way. So that's very cool. And then I'll just do a shameless plug. But, you know, I sit on a number of boards too. And if anyone listening to the show wants to volunteer or get involved, and I'm going to put your name out there too. And any of the boards I sit on or anyone that Palmina sits on, reach out to us and we will help get you involved because to what she just said, it is important. It will help you in your career, no matter what stage of your career you're in. And so I will consider that a piece of advice for the next generation of leaders, right? We always want to be developing that next generation. What, any other advice you'd like to share other than get involved with some of these industry organizations?
I think communication barriers is a big one. And I don't mean language barriers, but I mean interpretation. So if you're working with a baby boomer versus working with a Gen X or working with a Gen Y or Z or whatever letter we're up to these days, right? I've come to learn that generally speaking, a lot of times we're saying the same things, but we're saying them differently. So there's a lack of interpretation. So I think it's the time, and I've learned this with my nieces, right? I learned they are 20 in their 20s and they are vocal. And sometimes I understand what they're saying. Sometimes I just not really sure I get it, right? But it's important because it makes me think about things differently. It makes me understand that they're saying the same thing I'm saying. They're just saying it differently. So we're very like-minded in goals, but it's the words or the way we're communicating that's really different that can get lost in translation. So I would honestly, and this is, I say this for myself also, really get to learn who your audience is, understand who's in the room, and understand what kind of language they really speak, right? What's their mindset and what are they familiar with vocabularies that they're using that you can get the message point pretty clearly. Because speaking to somebody who's in their 20s versus speaking to someone who's in their 60s, probably have the same goal because we're all in business for the same reason, but it's how you say it that may resonate differently. And I'm still practicing that. It's taking a little bit of time for me, but it's really important that I know that if I'm speaking to an audience, that they're really understanding the intent of my message.
I know. So we were both at the national conference, right? I don't know if you were in the session where he goes through like the different types of...
I loved it. It was bridge words, right? And they did this. And when he said it, I thought, oh my God, he's right. This is
it's so right.
Right? But now you validated it. I'm not like, this is exactly what's happening.
And he tells the story of he's texting with his daughter and his daughter's like, why are you mad at me?
I know.
I'm not mad at you. She's like, you're using punctuation. And I thought to myself, I was like, I use punctuation in all of my text messages. Are we not supposed to do that? I didn't know that was a bad thing, but apparently.
Oh my goodness. Grandma at school. I was like, dog's good. Cannot make a mistake.
That was a great session. I loved what you said there is that we all have the common goal, right? So it's really not about alignment, at least for the most part, but it probably is a lot about communication. So I'm
more so than we realize, Eric. It really is.
Yeah. No, I definitely see it. And I think there are times where like I change how I communicate depending on who I'm talking to. And because I know what's going to resonate with them and I know what they're going to understand or even interpret from what I'm saying. And I want to make sure I'm as clear as possible so that when they go and execute whatever we're looking to get done, it gets done the way we need it to get done. I'm a big quotes guy. So I wanted to ask you, are there any quotes or mantras you live by or anything you grew up with?
Yeah, there's one. And I used it when I was starting my own business, right? When I retired from American and then decided to pilot a small women-owned business. And it is the best way to predict the future is to create it.
I love that. And you know what? Let's talk about that. I mean, what is it like to have your own small business? What were the challenges you expected? What were the challenges you didn't expect? And what are some of the successes you weren't expecting? Like just generally give us a broad stroke there. How are you feeling about it?
So, you know, it's interesting because that also was very organic. It just developed into itself. I was considering piloting myself and redefining my career and leaving aviation as a whole after American just because there was just so much work happening, right? That when I stopped moving, it was like you're stunned of how much you moved until you stopped. And I thought, well, there has to be a better way in life. I'm going to go recreate myself. And colleagues of mine just called and was asking for help. And when I realized that I was going to get paid for it, I was like, wow, wait, I can get paid for this? This is amazing. Why didn't I think of that? So it morphed into this me helping out colleagues to me then developing a business. And I have to say, it was a great experience. It was a great experience to be able to take something from true empathy stage. I've done it in my career in buildings, but I've never done it in my career for a particular, like a business or an enterprise that would be my own. So to be able to take something and create it from empathy stages and really quite decide which path and what direction and where I want to take it and having that type of control over that destiny, that part I like a lot. Right. I've worked in the aviation industry and I've worked on these big programs, but these big programs all had extreme tight deadlines and they had extreme set budgets. Right. There was not a lot of fluidity in any of it. And your day was kind of figuring out how to reach the finish line in the compressed schedule and budget that they were giving you to work with. This one was a little bit of, hey, well, what do you really want it to be? What market sector do you really want to work in? Who do you want to work with? Right. And what projects do you want to be on? So it was a privilege to have that experience. So it's cool. I mean, we're still a boutique firm and it's a decision that is a conscious decision, right? Which is that's another nice experience also is to consciously know that I'm deciding to maintain myself as a boutique firm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always do a little bit of research, I guess, before they come on. So I looked at the website. It looks amazing. I don't know who did it, if you built it, but it looks really nice. and some amazing programs on there. You know, I think there was like a handful of aviation projects that looked really exciting.
Yeah. And we're fortunate because we have, I mean, we're a small team, but we just happen to be on good legacy programs. Like, for example, we're a part of a team that did the first noise abatement study for JFK. It's never been done before. I mean, how long has JFK been existing, right?
So yeah.
A pilot program like that, that's amazing. So it's the type of programs that are really interesting too, that I get to be that specific.
Well, I love that you get to pick what you work on and who you work with. And I'm sure those were maybe two things you didn't have as much freedom on prior to having your own business.
Yeah. Probably not, Eric.
That was great. So with that, I'm going to take us into our lightning round as we're at the end of the show. As I mentioned to you, these are going to be fun questions. So be free, whatever you want to say. First one, what is your favorite thing to do in the summer?
Tan.
Yeah.
No, like, everything to do is to sit on the beach, honestly. It's to sit on the beach in the warm and just listen to the ocean. There's just something therapeutic about the water.
I like the ocean. I'm not a big beach person, but my wife loves the beach. So
yeah. The lake is not the same. There isn't a lot of movement in the lake, right? There has to be water moving.
All right, here's another one. I'm going to take you way back. But grade school, middle school, what was your favorite subject in school?
Ooh, social studies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you like, history or did you like another component of social
history?
Stuff? Yeah.
Yeah.
I love history too. So are you like a U.S. history? Are you European history or Far East Asian history?
No, it doesn't. Yeah. Probably more of European history than U.S. history.
Cool.
Yeah. I'm one of those, like, literally as a child, my father brought me a set of encyclopedias and I was so unbelievably excited because Google didn't exist back then.
No, I love to learn, and history is just so fascinating. And, you know, you start to do research and you're like, that really did repeat itself, like almost exactly the way it happened before. That's so crazy.
Yeah.
Favorite movie genre?
I'm a feel-good type of person.
Me too.
Yeah, I just have too much going on in my life. Yeah. I can't have any more anxiety when I come home and watch TV or rent a movie or go to the movies. Yeah, it has to be feel-good.
Do you have a favorite movie?
I don't. Is that? And I don't ever watch a movie more than once. Yeah, I've seen it, done, over with, moving on to the next.
And then this one, and I deliberately said international because I think there's just too many airports you'd have to name here. But what's your favorite international airport?
Everyone always asks me what my favorite airport is. And I tell you, Eric, I don't know how to answer that. That's not like a cop-out. I really don't, because every airport today has a different kind of sense of it. Right? So I don't have a favorite.
That's okay.
Honestly, whatever airport is going to get me there, like wherever I can go into the country traveling, I'm going to like that airport because I'm
where you want to be.
Going there. Right.
Very cool. Well, with that, I will say thank you. We're just about out of time. And if you know anything we mentioned, if there's any show notes needed, the links will be in our show notes at the end of this episode. And thank you everyone for listening. Palmina, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you, Eric. And thank you for your team for all the help.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Building Better Futures. The show notes include links to any resources mentioned in today's show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.